The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Our first guest today is the director of the National Cyber Security Centre, which has today released the National Cyber Emergency Plan. Its director, Richard Brown, joins us. Richard, thank you for joining us. And let's just get some explanations first, please. What exactly is the National Cyber Security Centre?
Well, thanks, Matt, and thanks for having me on. The National Cyber Security Centre is the state's primary cybersecurity agency. Our main responsibility is to detect, monitor, and respond to cybersecurity incidents in the state. But beyond that, we have a whole range of cyber resilience building responsibilities, including capacity building, so jobs and skills and questions like that, but also some broader issues like setting requirements for government agencies and entities and enforcing several different European directives on issues like cyber resilience.
Okay, and then what is the National Cyber Emergency Plan that you've published today?
So essentially, this morning we published the first published version of a National Cyber Emergency Response Plan. This is the overarching national framework setting out how we will, as a state, across government, respond to cybersecurity emergencies that reach a particular threshold. So, I mean, just for your listeners, we deal with about 700, well, that's last year's figure, significant cybersecurity incidents a year. But very few of those reach a threshold where we need a public coordinated response. However, we can't discount the possibility, and we've seen it happen here before, that we'll have a significant incident that will require a whole-of-government response. This plan sets out how we will do that, both at a national and at a European level.
Okay, if we go back 3 years, I suggest many people will probably remember what happened within our health system when there was a form of cyber attack, wasn't there, on the HSC, which impacted on the ability of computers to do their jobs and therefore impacted on the ability of doctors and nurses to treat patients. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, and how vulnerable are we to something like that happening again? And if it wasn't just the HSC, where else should we be worried about?
Last year we published, around this time last year in fact, the National Cyber Risk Assessment. That assessment set out at great length the types of issues and risks that we see occurring. The situation has disimproved since then, but not dramatically so. We have outlined there's about six or seven different high-level types of incidents we could see. And some of these happen, you know, on a daily basis around the world. The US, for example, have seen three or four really significant healthcare-related ransomware attacks in the last couple of months, and we're not immune from that here. I think there's two things to take away, though, from the work we've done in the last while. The first is that we've spent a huge amount of time and effort and colleagues across government and in critical infrastructure in building better resilience within the HSC and elsewhere. You can't deny the possibility these incidents could occur. But at least we're much better prepared to respond, you know, at a sectoral level and across government if the issue were to arise. The second issue is that these risks are pervasive. There's a thing that we refer to as systemic cyber risk. The incident affecting CrowdStrike in the last couple of weeks is an example of this, whereby you could have an incident affecting a software or a service or a vendor, which could promulgate across sectors. So you can have unknown, if you like, dependencies on different products. We have to be ready for an incident that can occur from any different vector. So this is why our response is designed at a high level. We are flexible and adaptive, and we can deal with incidents as and when they occur.
Okay, I don't want to catastrophize in relation to this, and I don't want to sound a bit like fiction, something like the movie The Italian Job, where suddenly somebody manages to knock out all of the traffic lights in a particular city. Although that's the type of example, isn't it, of what a cyber attack can do. It can knock out all of your transportation network. It could deal with air traffic control, which could be of a danger to flights. It could knock out all of your banking. It could shut down electricity. Am I catastrophizing, or is that possible?
You're catastrophizing. But I suppose the important thing is it's not completely impossible. The more likely types of incidents that we would see on a daily basis and, you know, could occur are far more limited in their effect. To do that kind of, if you like, Die Hard 4 is the movie reference I tend to use, is extremely complex, and it's never been done anywhere. If you look at what happened to our friends in Ukraine in the first couple of months of the most recent Russian invasion, they were subject to, if you like, the full spectrum of tools that the Russian state could bring to bear. And there were relatively limited effects on their society. Yes, there were attempts to delete information from government IT infrastructure. There were further revised attempts on their energy infrastructure. But none of these were particularly effective. So while it's theoretically possible to have these kind of large-scale destructive effects across society, it's very, very rare, and it's never really been used in that way, despite all of the catastrophizing from a load of different people. I think the other thing that's sitting in the background here is that there are some large-scale attacks that have been conducted in the past. Stuxnet, the attack on the Iranian uranium enrichment facilities being a case in point. But those took huge effort. I mean, vast amounts of time, money and resources went into those attacks. So it's not simple to conduct a destructive cyber attack in that way. What is possible, and this is where we come in, is you can have lower-level attempts or lower-level attacks that can disrupt services and can disrupt, you know, the lives of individual citizens. And that's a key part of our role, to ensure that the incidents we detect and the incidents we manage don't ever escalate to that kind of...
Yeah, Richard, it strikes me that there are two different areas here, that there's the state and all of the things that it provides, but there also may be private enterprise which are doing things that are very important to citizens of the country as well. So, for example, banking is very important to the country, but it's done by the private sector. Even things like internet provision or whatever is done by the private sector. So do the likes of the American multinationals who might be based here in Ireland, who have cloud storage facilities, for example, do they perhaps protect themselves somewhat better than the state does for its activities?
So I know it's the drive time show, and I don't want anybody dozing off at the wheel, but there are European regulations in place on the protection of critical infrastructure, which apply across public and private sectors, and don't distinguish between one or the other. It's true to say, of course, that there are global standards that apply to cloud and other services, which have been in place for many years. So there is a broad spectrum of resilience type activity taking place across all of these sectors, government and private sector. And that's a process that's ongoing and developing, and the MIS2 legislation coming into place towards the end of this year will change that as well. I think it's important to point out everybody has their own security requirements and their own security measures in place. They differ depending on the risk factor and everything else, but you know, this is not something that people are just thinking of today for the very first time. The other thing, of course, is that most of these businesses are international in nature. So you will have businesses, for example, in crowd provision, who will have footprints in across the European Union and in the US and elsewhere. So they will be meeting multiple different sets of security requirements at any given point in time. These are very heavily secured industries because of the amount of resources and, you know, other people's information that they carry.
Okay. Two questions to finish, Richard. They both come in from Niall and Cork. And the first one is, what level of risk is there from hostile nations attacking the undersea cables that run off our coast?
So this isn't strictly within our remit, but it is covered in the risk assessment we produced last year. And so we have, and as the state as a whole, and I'm talking about colleagues in the Defence Forces and the Gardaí, been engaged on this for quite a while, and we have a very good understanding of the specific, and I mean the very specific risks, including the vessels involved, the tools, the techniques and the procedures involved. You can't deny that there's a possibility of this type of thing occurring, but it still remains relatively low because an attack on critical undersea infrastructure would be a very significant step by any nation state, and it, you know, there's no hiding who has done it in those circumstances. So it's an issue. It's perhaps not as likely or as, you know, as probable as you might sometimes hear, but it is absolutely an issue. The thing to point out, of course, is that these undersea systems are all duplicated. An attack on one or even two is unlikely to have any significant effect on systems and services here or in any other European Union member state. It would take a very significant number of these pieces of infrastructure to be disrupted for it to have any kind of systemic impact.
Okay, and one final one. And this has come up, I think, in some media coverage recently. Whatever about the intentions that you have to make sure that we're protected, do you have the budget and do you have the personnel to do the job? Because the suggestions have been that you're understaffed and that you might also struggle to be able to pay the pay rates that the private sector for similar jobs would.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So we have specific salary scales for the NCSC that are higher than the rest of the public service. We are recruiting heavily at the moment. The government target set for us 2 years ago was for 70 staff by the end of this year. We'll hit 75 in the next couple of months, so we're going to be ahead of target. In terms of the ability to recruit staff, our most recent competition for cybersecurity responder, which is the lowest level we recruit at, people start at about €72,000 a year. We had 250 applicants for those three roles. We'll probably end up taking six or seven people in out of those 250 applicants. So we have a huge amount of interest. from very well qualified people, both because we pay relatively well in the public sector context, but also because of the type of work and the quality of work that we do and people have access to. So we've seen no issue whatsoever in access to very well qualified staff. Looking forward, of course, government always has competition for resources, and we will, you know, continually look to expand the capabilities and the services we provide to the state. That's a function of the budgetary process, and we have to wait and see what government has in store for us.
Richard Brown, Director of the National Cybersecurity Centre, thank you for joining us.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper, weekdays from 4:30. Today.